Hey, I'm Steve Young, and you're watching the Letterman Podcast. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome once again to the Letterman Podcast. My name is Mike Chisholm. I am really excited for this episode. Broken record. I'm excited for all of them. Yada, yada, yada. Amy, Sharon Humes came on the show today. We just had an amazing conversation. She was, among other things in the show, the assistant to Jerry Foley. At a time, which was a pretty crazy moment in Letterman history, Hal Gurney retired. Jerry Foley took over as the full-time director and did it perfectly, as far as I'm concerned. If there was a perfect person to take over for the legendary Hal Gurney, it was Jerry. Well, Amy was certainly a part of that. She was there for it. She helped figure out what it was going to look like. She didn't even have a description in her job, really, at that point. They kind of figured the whole thing out. She also did other things with the production as well. We get into that a little bit. She started as a page and then wormed her way into the guild, the Directors Guild, I believe it is, so she could be a stage manager as well, and talks about that. Has an amazing story and quite the kid, a 17-year-old son who's got a book that's about to come out. I love this episode so much. We're just going to get right to it. Please enjoy it. Now, there's a couple little technical things that happen throughout it. Somebody decided to do some work outside of the house. I hope that doesn't translate to the show itself, on the audio perspective. And then we had a little blurb in the middle. I'm just going to keep it all in there because the conversation was so good. But the Letterman Podcast, proud to present Amy Sharon Hughes. Amy, something that you just said before I hit the record button has got me so excited. Your office was right across from Shecky. You got to see Rick a lot when you worked at your time at Late Show.
Yes, I did. Actually, I didn't even have an office. I had a desk in a hallway, in a little niche in the hallway, but that was okay. And it was right outside Shecky's office. And so he was always, you know, kind of standing in the doorway and, you know, kind of giving me advice and asking me what was going on. And we'll really miss him.
I do too. One of the things that Rick told me was that he was really good at just staying in his lane. He knew the lane he was in, and there was lots of what you were just talking about, talking with people, giving advice. They called him a film coordinator, but you know, you had writers and people coming up to him and showing him some of the video pieces, the extras that they would do, asking him, you know, do we need this? Do we need that? What should we do to this? Really, in a lot of ways, and I can say this myself personally, like just a sage that kind of knew. He had an opinion on everything or a wide variety of things anyway. And they were good opinions. Like it was yes. Solid stuff.
Yes. He really knew his stuff and what knowledge of, I mean, he could just pull, the writers would ask him, oh, we need footage of, I mean, some random thing. And he would find it in black and white and, you know, stop motion, whatever. I mean, it was just incredible. He just knew right away. He had an amazing, amazing depth of knowledge.
Something that he and Don Giller have in common. Whenever I talk to Don about the show, he's able to pull so quickly information as to when and where this happened. Rick could do that in the entire world of film, especially old film. I loved Rick so much. Okay, let's go back to the beginning for you. Amy, when did you start with Late Show?
It was somewhere in the early 90s. They had moved to CBS mm-hmm. just that year before, I believe. And I was Jerry Foley's, no, I'll go back a bit. Yeah. So they had just moved to CBS and I had been working in New York as like a production assistant, doing a lot of off-Broadway stuff, running around, doing a lot of theater. And I was getting kind of burnt out, working crazy hours and everything. And a friend of mine connected me with the CBS page program. And so I became page and I worked in all kinds of, I mean, every show at CBS and the news and, you know, Geraldo and all the crazy things. Dan Rather did that. That was intense. And then I was lucky enough to get the assignment of backstage page, which every page wanted. It's a month long assignment and you stand at the stage door and you escort guests from their limos to their dressing room or, you know, wherever they need to go. So I did that and toward the end of that assignment, And I just loved, I mean, it was like the first time in my life, first of all, that I had ever been cool, which was, you know, standing at that stage door. I was never a cool person until then, or I thought I was pretty cool then. And I just loved everyone there. And so they asked me to interview, Morty was looking for an assistant. Yeah. And I was like, I'm getting this job. And then I interviewed, but yeah, Jennifer Cunningham got that job. And, but they said, well, why don't you interview for this other job? So I interviewed with Janice Panino.
Yeah.
And she hired me to be in the ticket office with one other guy, Sean Gottlieb.
Yep.
And at the time you had to send in a postcard to get tickets for the show. So we would sit with stacks of postcards, and every day all we did, Sean liked Frank Sinatra. So we had Frank Sinatra playing, and the two of us would sit side by side and just type in addresses all day long. And that was fun for a while. And then Jerry Foley.
Yeah. How long? A couple of weeks.
Yeah. Maybe? No, I mean, we actually, Sean and I had a great time, and we would talk, you know, the feed would come into the office so we could, you know, watch what was going on. And
oh, that's cool. You could see the rehearsals and all of that
stuff.
Yeah.
It's like we were, I mean, that's what's so great about that show is no matter how, like Bob Borden started in the mailroom, you know, like no matter how insignificant your job seems to be, there was always, you were just part of the family. It was like right away. It was just the way it was. And so we had a blast. And then I don't know how many months I was there, but it was a while. And Jerry needed his assistant. So I interviewed and I got the job.
Yep.
And that was amazing. I think I was his first assistant, and it was my first time being an assistant to a director, you know, at the Late Show.
Yeah.
So I had no idea what I was doing, and he didn't really know what to ask me to do. So we just kind of figured it out. And he really became a mentor to me and very, very good friend. And that's how it happened.
I want to go back to when you were a page. So you were a page working for CBS.
Yes.
And your gig was to stand right in the sense between, you know, right a few feet away from the Hello Deli. And,
yes.
And when people would get out of the car, you would take them and escort them to the green room. That was your gig.
Yes. Yep. That was my gig. Usually they'd put you on like news in the morning or do something in the morning. And then every afternoon you're over at the Late Show. And, when you're backstage page, it's like really fun because you're finally back there. Right. So you're meeting all the guests. And I once turned away Deborah Harry. I didn't know she was Deborah Harry. And, she came with this big, scarf over her head and sunglasses. And she said, you know, I'm here and I want to come backstage. And I said, well, you know, there were always all kinds of wild people at the stage door wanting to come in. So I said, well, you know, who are you? You know, I have my list here with my clipboard and everything. And she said, Deborah Harry. And I said, oh my goodness, Miss Harry, please come in, you know? And, I was just mortified, but anyway.
You, okay. So that gig there, did it always stay a CBS gig or it became a pants gig when Janice kind of created the internal program at that point?
Maybe
right?
Like when you were... I was there, it was still CBS.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So it was still a CBS deal. In that time that you did that month long gig, any memorable, folks, any memorable trips from 53rd to the green room, anybody that you were, holy cow, I can't believe this is happening. And you kind of got hyper present at that moment. Were there any moments that stick out?
During that time, not as much. Definitely once I started stage managing the show occasionally, which is another, you know, story of how that happened.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, then I have a lot more memories. I mean, really what happened when you're a backstage page, they get off like literally right at the curb and you say right this way. And it's like a 20-foot, you know, as wide as the sidewalk, you're with them.
Yep.
But I would say the Deborah Harry thing was a big one. There was a Miss America. Oh, Vanessa Williams came once.
Oh, wow.
And that was kind of like, I was pretty nervous about that one. But mostly it was the way I felt, and this goes forward to my entire time at the show, I just always had this pervading feeling that I'm working with people who allowed themselves to achieve their wildest dreams. I just always, it's like every day I was like, wow, I'm working with people who didn't build boundaries around themselves, who didn't, I mean, they have certain walls, obviously, and we're all sure. human, but there was something so remarkable about being around people who were living like that.
That is a very, very well said. Talk about save the best for last with Vanessa Williams. That is a very well said statement. I believe that the body, like, you know, we talk about the show as a celebration of the body, the greatest body of broadcasting work in history, that of David Letterman and company. The company part was a group of remarkable creatives in many respects, creatives and then folks who were just really good at their job on technical sides of things. But like you say, I think a commonality between it all is thinking big and not yes. being afraid to do something big. I was just in New York talking to some of the union guys that have made it over from Late Show yeah. to the new Late Show with Colbert. I was talking mm-hmm. with an older guy named Bill Palumbo. I don't know if you remember Bill or not. And he's talking about mm-hmm. the things that they built on 53rd Street. He's talking about the ski jump and all of the things that they had to do for literally a 2-minute spot on TV. And then they take it apart and bring it all down. I love that about the show, that the show would create these grandiose things. Well, in order to create grandiose things, you needed grandiose people and minds.
Yes.
And it sounds like those minds helped you with your mentality going through life. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, they just had so much courage, and I was really in awe of these people, and they were all so brilliant, and I just couldn't believe I was, you know, lucky enough to get to be around them, you know, yeah. and regarding 53rd Street, this is kind of one quirky thing I had to do when I worked for Jerry. My job was anytime they wanted to close 53rd Street, I had to go to the New York Office of Film and TV and get the permit to close the street. So every time they saw me coming, you know, it was one of those kind of government offices, and
yep.
And I'd go upstairs and they'd roll their eyes. What does he want to do now? And I was like, well, we want to drop, you know, bowling balls off the building or whatever it was, or have. And it was crazy.
This is amazing. I have, without understanding and knowing that it was you, I have been wanting to talk to you for a long time. Okay.
Really?
Now there's a whole bunch of questions that have now shown up where I didn't know who the person to talk to was. Okay. Was this office in the office building of the Ed Sullivan Theater? Cause there was yes. a city office there, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So that was quite convenient to their, yeah. much to their dismay. Cause each request was wilder than the last. I mean, they had to not just approve closing the street, but also sometimes it was like, in 20 minutes, we really want to close the street to do this. And usually there's a long process and all this stuff. But they were great, and they always helped us out. And and
was there literally, like, was that hyperbole, or like, are there times where no, in 20 minutes we want to close the street? Did that actually happen?
There were times, I can't think of a specific time. There were times that it happened so fast. Maybe it felt like 20 minutes, but it could have been 20 minutes. I mean, there were times where someone had an idea, or a lot of times, like, you know, when the guests would arrive and they would talk to the producers, you know, yeah. before the show, and they'd have an idea. Like, guess what would be funny? We want to do XYZ. And then everybody would scramble and say, that's great. And things would happen. And I mean, yeah, the props and costumes and the set scenic builders. And I mean, everybody who would just jump and create things that were so incredible with a moment's notice. It was really remarkable.
Absolutely. The reflexive action of Late Show was astounding. Yeah. I want to stay on this for a minute, because this is fascinating to me that you would go up and get these approvals. Can you think of any moments where there was pushback, where the city was like, no, you guys are going too far, you're going to have to retool this or rethink this? Or did they always say yes, just loving the fact that Dave was there?
No, I mean, they definitely, I had to beg a lot of times. And I think there was one time, this is a little off color, but we did a remote at Hooters, which at the time was kind of across Broadway and around the corner kind of. And they wanted to, I can't remember how we grabbed several women who were working there and ran them across Broadway. And I can't remember if we had to, maybe that's not a good example. We might have had to approve that, but that also might've been a spur of the moment thing where someone just held up their hands and, you know, all of us ran across. But yeah, I'm trying to think if there was a time, I mean, all the time, it was a little bit of pushback, but I don't remember them ever. I'm sure they did say no, but I don't remember them saying no.
Was there a person, a specific person in that office where it was just their job, or were there a couple people that were there and you're like, oh, I hope I get this person today. I hope I get.
Oh, no, there was usually just one person there who yeah. rolled her eyes and said, what is it today? I mean, when she saw me coming, she knew things were going to get a little complicated. And so, yeah, but it was pretty cool. I mean, the things like you mentioned before, just the ski jumps and, oh my gosh, the outdoor, you know, summer rock concerts that we, that they had out there. And that sometimes if it had to be closed off for a long period of time for, you know, an extensive, like building a stage or something, that was pretty difficult. And when they had to really staff it with police officers but we had Bill DeLace, who was, do you know Bill?
I do. We had a really nice chat at Rupert's retirement party, and I think Chief is coming on the show. It looks like he's going to be coming on, and I'm pretty excited about that. Bill DeLace is his stories have stories. My goodness.
Oh, he used to tell some stories, but he was always great because he had an in, you know, with the NYPD. So if we needed some extra people, you know, to direct traffic, and when it closed, it was it's Midtown. It caused a lot of disruption. So he was always great to help get whoever we needed.
Was it always Jerry who sent you to do these things, or were there a plethora of people who might at a moment's notice or with advance notice need to close off 53rd Street?
It was always Jerry. It would always come through Jerry, but what would happen is he'd, you know, hear in rehearsal, okay, we're going to need X, Y, Z. And then he came to me, he called me or came up to me and told me. Yeah.
This is awesome. Talking about this stuff. I love it so much. Moving over to Jerry now for a second. If there was an unenviable shadow to be in, Hal Gurney's might be the tallest when it comes from a technical standpoint in television history. Jerry Foley took over for Hal Gurney. Is this right at the time when you got hired? Is that, was that Ascension? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You talk about big shoes to fill. But Jerry had been there for a while. And I mean, obviously had the tone of the show and all of that stuff. Obviously they tapped the right guy because he was there till the end. I mean, if there is a guy to take over for Hal Gurney, Jerry Foley certainly showed that he was the guy. Was there nervousness and trepidation as he was moving into that role?
You know, I think similar to the people I was describing earlier on, I'm sure there had to have been some nervousness, but he was, from what I could tell, just of the mind, well, here I am. I'm lucky enough to have gotten this gig. So let's just go for it and give it all we've got, you know? And it's not that, I mean, day-to-day stress, I mean, that show moves fast and things change and, you know, and I'm sure that was stressful for him, but boy, he just jumped right into it. And it is true, because he was TD before, he knew, so much about the cameras, and he also knew all the players. It wasn't like he was coming in fresh and had to meet everybody. And he had a good rapport with all the cameramen already. And,
for sure. Yeah. That being said, it's Late Show with David Letterman, the director is a character in the show, and it was established that way very early on. Maybe not an on-screen camera. I know Jerry didn't do near as much voice work as Hal did, but a character nonetheless. Like, he needed to know when he was going to do that shot of somebody in the audience or somebody, like, you know, in the middle of an interview or in the middle of Dave doing something and then shooting somewhere else to add that comedic effect. You know, and I mean, just did an incredible job of taking that role over. Were you in the control room with him during Showtime?
Most of the time. Yeah. On the nights, that I was stage managing, obviously I was out on the stage, but, or backstage, But otherwise, yes, I was in the control room every night. So I'd usually sit next to Shecky, or sometimes Jude Brennan was there, and different producers, if it was their segment, they'd come down to the control room. But I was in the back row there. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Great. That's interesting. So if somebody produced a certain segment, they would come down just for that segment into the control room?
Sometimes they would. It depended what was happening on stage. Sometimes they'd stand at the podium out on the stage and be there. It really depended. But so it wasn't always the exact same people every night in the back row. People would come and go. But but I was there, and Shecky, and Amy Rubin was there for a long time. Yeah.
She's somebody I want to talk to as well. Was Vinny there at your during your time?
Oh yeah,
as well?
toward end of my time there, Vinny was there, and he was great too, and always laughing his head off, and really nice man.
Big fan of Vinny Favalli. I'm a big fan of that guy.
me too.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Okay, so you get the job as Jerry's assistant. You guys are kind of defining the job, I suppose. From where you started to when it ended, what did it, if you were to be in the middle somewhere, when you kind of figured out, you got your legs under you, you kind of knew what you're doing, what would an average day look like for you? From hours, was there a routine to it? Obviously with the chaos of having to do things, but was there sort of a routine to it?
Yes. I mean, I know Chris Shukai remembered the whole entire schedule. When I listened to his podcast, it was like hour by hour. And I thought, my God, how did this man remember every hour? But I know I usually got in around 9:30, 10. Yep. And my job was to try to keep Jerry's, he had a big whiteboard calendar in his office, and, you know, listing what guests were on each day and that week, and actually that month, but it changed constantly. So I tried to keep that updated for him. So in the morning, I would try to give the most updated, get that information from the talent department, which was also on 11 down the hall. Yeah. So try to get that info from them, and then and write it on his board. And then the other thing that I did for him was he was really amazing shooting the music for the day, you know, whoever was on, whatever the musical act was on.
Yep.
So what I would do is write down all, you know, there was no like real internet to search lyrics, but I would listen to the song over and over and write down all the lyrics as best as I could understand, and divide it into measures. Each line I divided into musical measures. And then during musical rehearsal, we would be out on stage. Jerry would go out and like kind of catch, and on my notes, when I divided it into measures, I would write like drum solo here or guitar solo here or whatever. And then we'd all go down to rehearsal, and Jerry would kind of decide what shots he wanted to get. And he would write out kind of a long shot sheet for different places in the song. And then I would, you know, copy those. And then right before the music happened, I'd run out on stage and hand out all these sheets to the camera guys, and they would clip it to their next to their camera so they could see as the taping was going on, where they were roughly supposed to go next and when. And and then someone in the control room, sometimes it was me, usually it was Jessica Santini, would count kind of Jerry through the song and say drum solo now, you know, and then Jerry would call the camera. So it was a whole process, and it ended up working really well. And Jerry was just so great at catching all those little moments and in the music. But that was a really fun part of my job to get to do that.
Are you a music fan, Amy?
A music fan. I mean, I have a little bit of a musical background.
Yeah.
So, and I love music. So some of these people, when they were on, it was pretty exciting for me.
I'm going with it, because boy, oh boy, you get to see these world-class musicians of every genre imaginable.
Yes.
From obscure but amazing all the way to the top of pop culture and everything in between. But you got a job to do, and you're trying to be technical and all that. Were there times where you got caught up and you missed something on the list because the music caught you up? Like, were there some moments that you saw that stick out?
Oh my gosh. I don't remember. I'm sure I made lots of mistakes. Definitely because I was in awe of some of these people. I mean, some of my most memorable moments with musicians were like just the warm-heartedness of some of them. Like Dolly Parton would always walk up, like if I was in rehearsal, "Hi there, darling," and she'd give me a big hug and just like sunshine pouring out of that woman. And Elvis Costello would sometimes walk up to me on stage and go, "What do you?" Because he always would bring like some, like sometimes he'd bring like a gospel choir to back him up or some lesser known musician. And he was always, I feel like, I don't know if this was his intent, but I'd like to think it was that he always tried to kind of promote people because he had this platform. So sometimes he'd walk over and say, "Well, what do you think about, this today? Like I was kind of trying this and that, and did you like that?" And I mean, he'd want to talk about it, and I was like, I have no opinion, but I'm so happy to listen. I mean, it was just such an opportunity to be close to these people.
What you
Yeah.
just described, there were a lot of people in the Pants family who were the people who would put a hand down to bring people up. There are
Yes.
so many examples of that that have been on this show. I mean, this show's only been around a year and a half, but we have so many examples of folks. I mean, well, right there, like Rick alone, like
Yeah,
there are so many
absolutely.
people in the Pants family who tried to bring people up. And
Yes.
I don't know about you. That to me, that speaks to my heart. I love that so much.
Yeah.
And to
Yeah.
hear that there were
So true.
musicians on the grandest stage doing stuff like that, that's
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had, I mean, there were so many, like, the other memorable musician moment for me was when Prince was on and I was backstage that night. And at the time he was the cymbal. So, his handler, I greeted the handler first. I don't know his manager or who this person was, assistant, but I said, "I'm so sorry, but can you tell me what to call him? Because I don't know how to address him." And because he was a cymbal. And he said, "He will be fine. Just call him he." And I was like, "Okay, I will." And then I remember they had to redecorate his entire dressing room, covering it in purple satin. And when he was, this was the craziest time backstage, like at the stage door. That's the craziest time I can remember was when Prince was on. And there were a lot of crazy times, but that one was really nuts. It was like the Beatles were on or something. And so I was backstage that night. He finishes his song, and of course, it's amazing. And his security guy, he ended the song like lying down flat on the stage.
Yeah, he did the gun thing and fell down, and then the
Yeah.
security guy came and picked him up, and
Picked him up like a baby, carried him out backstage, out through the backstage area to the past the green room. Prince had a woman with him that night. I don't know who she was, but what happened is they stepped outside, they went right to the limo. He carried him to the limo. But as he was carrying him, people were hurling their bodies over the police barricades, trying to get to him. And so the security guard put him in the limo, shut the door, and drove away. And I was left standing with the woman that was with Prince, and I had to call her another car. Yeah, that was my main memory of Prince.
That was an incredible moment, and I mean, you talk about, there's all these artists who are larger than life, and I think that I want to be very careful as I talk about this here. I don't want to be insensitive in any way, shape, or form. I think that when you get these larger than life artists that create this amazing new creative type music, I think in this world now, right now, there isn't room for the fact that a mind like that is going to be a different mind. They're going to think differently. They're going to have other
Yes.
eccentricities, if you want to call it that. Prince certainly being an example of that. We love to celebrate the genius, but sometimes the other things that come with that,
Yeah.
we judge and they think is a little bit strange. But if you want amazing art, you need it from
Oh, and it's just the
interesting
best.
people.
Yeah, I mean, when you get to to me, it's like I just loved all those eccentricities because it really made well, it made the job very interesting and exciting, and I just found it so fascinating.
Yeah, and you saw a lot. You saw a lot of crazy musical moments, crazy moments, in your job there.
Yeah.
Would you be, and I mean, anytime, by the way, if something, this is jazz, using musical motif. If a memory comes back of music and we're talking about something else, throw it in there. Like
Okay.
that's
Cool. I will.
fantastic.
Thank
But
you.
at the same time, I think about some of the extras, comedy extras, and again, just a testament to Jerry. You're talking about a guy who, in my opinion, when it comes to musical acts in late night, I believe Late Show with David Letterman is the top of the heap. We had Harvey Goldberg on here. We talked about the audio part of that,
Yeah.
making the studio but live experience and merging them together. I love that. Jerry obviously did that on the visual side of things.
Yes.
So that he's an expert in. But then also when it comes to the comedy extras and things like that, and he's got to put different directing caps on. Maybe there's a bit with Alan Coulter where we're making it look like a Scorsese film, or maybe we're going to make it look like a musical, Broadway musical. You talk about your
Right.
theater background, some of the different things, the different eclectic things in genre that he and his team, which you were on, were responsible for, was unbelievable. Was there ever anything that was a stretch, or was he just that multi-talented and just had that all in his repertoire?
Well, I think it was a team effort a lot of the time, so much of the time the producer would know what they would want and talk with Jerry, and Jerry had a great relationship with all those people, so they could work together, so I think if there was any uncertainty, I think they knew how to cover each other because everybody had the same goal, right? Everyone wanted to support Dave and make it a great show. Like, that's what it was. So whatever it took, people, and especially, because of the time crunch, I mean, it was a new show every day, and some, and on Thursdays, two shows. So it was just people were willing to pull together. There wasn't time to let someone sink or swim, So I think Jerry, from my memory, Jerry loved, he was in the control room a lot, which I think he loved, but I think having the opportunity when he would do remotes, there was one I so wanted to go to and they didn't let me go. I begged. They did a remote in Sting's apartment in Manhattan. And there was stuff like that. Like, I think Jerry probably loved doing that. And different opportunities he had to work directly with the talent was probably a lot of fun because he went to film school. I mean, he's a film guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did
Yeah,
you
so
see?
he
Oh, go ahead.
pivoted pretty easily, I think.
It sounds like you all did, and had to. It was just like you say, a necessity of the job was to be versatile. Did you go on a lot of comedy remote extras?
You mean as a perf like as a being a extra in the
No,
thing?
oh sorry. Like extras, the writers call them
Oh,
extras. They're like the little,
like a remote or something. Yeah, like a
Did you go on a
comedy
lot of
thing.
those?
I went on some. Yes, I did. Usually the ones I went on was just because I was like in a bunny suit or something in it. But I didn't do a lot of the, like, if they were, I did one actually, one remote that's really sticks out to me was Alan Coulter was the announcer at this moment. And we were in San Francisco and they sent us out with a camera guy and Alan just stood on, we rode the, trolleys or whatever, those on the streetcars. And he would just yell out, "Oh, is everything okay there?"
It's not. One second here.
Uh-oh.
Hold on. What just happened? Okay, it seems. Nope, maybe we are okay.
We good?
I think we're good. It seems recording all that. A window just popped up and I just had to get rid of it. I apologize for
Okay.
that.
No, that's
No, I think
okay. I
we're
didn't see
good.
the window on my end, so I was like, "Oh no, I thought you got some bad news or something." I guess
No,
you get.
sorry. Yeah, no, a window popped up in the middle of it and I'm like, "Oh God, no, I want this story so badly."
Okay.
I love Alan Coulter so much. So,
Oh, what a
you guys
nice
are in San
guy.
Francisco. Sorry about that. So, you're in San
No, that's
Francisco?
okay. So yeah, we were in San Francisco riding these streetcars or trolleys and up and down half the day, and with a camera guy filming him, and he would just, Alan would just, the bit was, he would just stand there and while riding the streetcar and say, bring me sourdough in this big, you know, voice. And of course I was running behind him, you know, getting people to sign releases so that if they appeared on the show that night, which was complicated because people were jumping on and off, and keeping track of all that was crazy. But yeah, but that was a fun time doing that.
So you traveled with the show to San Francisco. Where else did you travel with the show?
Where did I go? We did San Francisco a couple times, Los mm-hmm. Angeles, Miami. So I went on several. I went on a lot. And I mean, they did what they started doing. They used to bring everybody at the beginning when we started traveling. And then they started doing these kind of like world tour things where they would bring a smaller crew, and I didn't end up going on those. But San Francisco was one of the best. I have a great story about San Francisco. Want to hear it?
Yes, of course I do. So,
I wish I could remember the other guests, but I will say in my memory. So the way it went was we were in San Francisco that night, Tom Hanks, he was definitely on, and Robin Williams. And there was one other guest, and we were all backstage, and I was, you know, found myself chatting with them. And it came to be that Robin Williams was going to just go to a bar in San Francisco with a little stage, some tiny little place, you know, that seated maybe 50 people. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I'm going to show up and surprise them, and I'm going to do some stand up if you guys want to come. Oh. So there were, you know, a group of my friends. And we said, are you kidding? Of course we do. So we went, and he surprised everyone, and he did stand up. I mean, it must have been 3 hours straight. He just didn't stop. And I mean, I couldn't breathe. I was actually like ill from laughing so hard. It was just the most amazing, amazing memory. Yeah.
Do you remember who you were with? Night. Do you remember who all went?
I'm sure, you know, I was really good friends at the time. I'd have to ask them, Leslie Cahill and, gosh, Lorraine, and I don't know who else was there. I just remember, it's like, you know, my field of vision was like gone, and I was zeroed in on Robin Williams, and I just couldn't believe, once again, I mean, I just was black and blue from pinching myself all the time, that I was so lucky to get to be around these people and have these experiences. I mean, I still cannot believe. It seems like a, you know, it was so long ago. It just seems like a dream, like another lifetime, you know?
What a precious thing to have inside your memory banks. You actually segued really, really nicely here. Robin Williams is a good example of this. Sometimes you would have a guest come on the show who would want something extra, like whether it's an entrance, whether it is a pre-tape, you know, some of the guests who came on the show, they took it very, very seriously, and of course became friends of the show because of that, because they understood that this wasn't just promoting a movie. This is a special deal. Let's do something special for it. Do you have any memories of some of those guests, like Bruce Willis, Steve Martin? These are the ones that come to mind immediately who wanted to do stuff beforehand or outside of the show. Any memories of guests who came on that wanted to do something that might've been a little bit out of the norm?
I should have those memories. But it was a long time ago. So I must say, I remember all those pre-tapes happening and how crazy it would be and last minute. And I remember, you know, everybody rushing to make it happen and Jerry running downstairs and, you know, early trying to get it done. But I do not remember specific stories. I'm just, you know,
That's okay. Cause that's actually where the question was going. So let's just put Steve Martin in as a placeholder, you know? I mean, you know, one of the, there was always little pre-tapes with Steve that he would do kind of a thing. Were there ever times where you had a day's notice and we're going to do this, it's going to be really special, it's going to be good, but it's going to interrupt the flow of our day? Was there a lot of that?
Oh yeah. I mean, all the time. I mean, I think no matter what, the production meeting was the production meeting, and rehearsal time was always rehearsal time. And then music rehearsal was always music rehearsal. And of course, taping was just, it had to start. I believe it was 5:30. And that, just those things were constants in the day, but then the rest of it was kind of, you just never knew what was going to happen day to day. And that was very exciting. Yeah.
Isn't that funny how the routine of the day is a taping of the show, which you guys tried to make it look live as much as possible. It was a live experience, you know, the band playing through the commercial breaks real time. You wanted to get her done in an hour if you could. That was the goal, the gold standard. You know, but that's the most normal time of the day when some people would look at an environment like that and go, oh my God, that's the craziest time of the day. That speaks right there to what the production of Late Show was like. Did any Q&As ever go awry? I mean, there's lots of memories, especially at the beginning of the Q&A being something where Dave would literally, if it was 5:30, if they were in the middle of something, sometimes drop the microphone and go back and start. Any Q&A stories?
Oh gosh, you're asking me and I should.
No. It's all good. It's all good.
Not that I can remember. I think, they had security there. So I know that there were times that they had some super fans who maybe wanted to, you know, go up on stage and things like that. That wasn't really, maybe occasionally he took a picture with someone, but not usually. And, so I know that there was security around to make sure that no crazy people, or I shouldn't say crazy, but enthusiastic, ran up to the, you know, and just to keep everybody safe and whatever. But I don't remember any of them but I remember it would go down to the last millisecond sometimes. And just as you describe, drop the mic and run backstage, and there it started, and it happened very, very fast.
You probably don't know this about me. I had a Q&A moment with Dave.
Oh, I don't know that.
And it happened to be, it was in the New York Times. And so that's a month before he retired. And that's Dave talking to Paul going, Paul, those Canadians are supposed to be, you know, polite and all this sort of thing, using me as a comedy speed bag and me loving every second of it. The New York Times happened to capture it. The reason I bring that up is not to be self-aggrandizing, although I will do that from time to time. It's because one of the greatest things, I love that moment. It was fantastic. One of the greatest moments of my life. But then it's got a nice little suffix on the end of it. And that is the first date. We finish our conversation. Dave goes back. Show starts. He comes out to do the monologue. First thing he does is makes a reference to our talk. And as Hal Gurney pioneered way back in the day, this is a month before retirement, Jerry or somebody in the control room says, okay, cut to that guy. And they show me in the audience.
Amazing. Obvious,
that, which is, you know, every Letterman fan's kind of dream is to have that moment completely, where there's a reference to something that happened earlier and then the cut, right? A hallmark. So you guys have to pay attention to what's going on at all times, so you know to make that cut if possible. And was there a standard camera person that said, okay, you're the person who we're going to, you know, get you into the audience real fast, or get you to this or get you to that, to be in position sort of on the fly? Was it one person?
I don't know if it was more than, if it was always the same camera guy, but more than once I remember Jerry saying, okay, you know, cover to one of his cameramen, make sure you cover her, because I bet he's going to go back to her in the monologue. You know, he would listen to the Q&A and make sure if something like that happened, he was always on it. And you know, he did it a long time, Jerry. Yeah. So I think at first, you know, maybe he missed one. And then that was difficult, and probably never did it again. I mean, that's the thing with that show. I think you try not to make mistakes. And like when we were talking about the schedule, the taping schedule, it was so, I mean, they did everything. I can't even, maybe once or twice that we had to go back and retape something, but that was it. I mean, really, they tried to make it like a live show. So what you were seeing was really what happened. It was rare that something was retaped.
Yeah, I saw the show live twice, and both times I was astounded at whenever there would be any sort of flub up, how they would just keep rolling, and you had to watch for it. Like, you had to really, really watch.
Yeah.
And same with edits, like not a lot of stuff ended up on the cutting room floor. And I mean, the narrative is that later on, Dave got more and more talkative, and the editor's job, we're actually going to have two or three of the editors come on here, and we're going to have a really good podcast coming up. It's going to be a lot of fun. But but how tight the recording was and the show itself was is absolutely astounding.
Yeah. Also, Jessica and Randy, really, they were the ones that were in the edit every night for hours. I mean, they worked really long hours to make that look like it was perfect, you know? Yeah. And they really did a great job with that, shaving off a second here or there. And it came out looking like it was, you know, like it all happened exactly that way.
Yeah. During taping, were there ever times that you can remember where it's like, okay, here's a moment, like where it was something, whether it was a guest, whether what were some of those things that come to mind when I say that?
Oh my gosh. I mean, the night Drew Barrymore, it was Dave's birthday, I guess. And she didn't tell anyone she was going to do this. And she climbed up on his desk, you know, and turned her back to the audience and lifted her shirt as a gift to Dave. And, people just went wild and everyone in the control room was just howling. I mean, it was just one of those crazy, crazy moments that people couldn't believe.
I love so hearing that. Really, we had Dan Kellison on who produced that segment, and he talked about it from his perspective. I love hearing you talk about it, how we were all howling in the control room. I love
what did he say? That. What I'm curious what he said about it.
It was a nice drawn out story because he talked about, there was a, I forget the name of the bar. There was a bar in New York that Drew had just gone to, that mm-hmm. was sort of very avant-garde, very kind of free and all this kind of stuff. And they were having this conversation and, he certainly didn't tell her to do that. However, the conversation went far enough along that Paul had to be tipped in to have some of that swanky like blues music type music on the ready just in case something were to happen. Did definitely mention that it was his birthday, and so yeah, seeds That's were certainly funny. Planted for something to happen. But I love that the fact that you guys weren't necessarily tipped off on that. I think there's an art to producing something where you know something is going to happen versus the spontaneity. David Letterman as a broadcaster and as a performer and entertainer, certainly a master at making something spontaneous or something planned look like it was spontaneous.
Yes. But
part of the secret sauce was also, no, we're going to keep this as spontaneous for people like the director or something like that. So
absolutely.
They can shoot
and
it that
you
way.
May interview Jerry if he ever decides to do this. And yes. He may say, I knew something was happening, but to my memory, in the control room, it was like people went wild. Yeah. I mean, I wish I could think of more moments. I know there were many others. I mean, there was I hesitate to bring it up, but the Farrah Fawcett episode.
Yep. We've talked about it here on the show. And yeah, please do. Oh, all respect to Farrah and where she was
absolutely,
at and all of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Dave, by the way, handled her. It's not like Dave went and started using her. Like Dave could have gone the other way, and because the audience was sort of starting to turn or whatever, and Dave kind of protected her. We just talked about that with Joanna Jordan. So yeah. To preface, please go ahead and talk about Farrah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I have much to say except that it was shocking to everybody, and people could not believe it. I mean, it was just kind of stunning the way that the segment went. And then they made the decision to bump the other guests and just keep her on because it was so riveting.
Yep.
But I think people had mixed feelings about that. And, you know, sorry, I have a howling old lady cat in the background.
Oh, so we're good. No.
And so it was just, it was quite shocking when that happened. And there was a lot of reaction in the control room with that too. I mean, even when you plan things happen, or, you know, it's like, no matter how planned the show was, there were so many times that people would be shocked by what was actually happening. And it was fun. I mean, I laughed always, you know, I always, every day, I mean, I laughed, and that was a really great part about the job.
You get there at 10 in the morning. So at this point, you're deep into your time with being Jerry's assistant. What time do you leave on an average? Is there an average?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of lucky because I had nothing to do with the edit. So as much, I did try to a few times to have something to do with the edit, but it just wasn't my job. And so yeah. I hung out sometimes and watched them work and was just amazed by what they did. But yeah, so usually by, I don't know, 7:30, 8 o'clock, yeah. I was out the door, and usually everybody was meeting at McGee's next door.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to ask if you ever...
Yeah. So all the, I mean, McGee's, we were there all the time, and that was just great. And yeah, I mean, those people were really at that time, my best friends and family, and I have so many memories of, you know, Christmas parties at Woolman Rink and all kinds of fun things we got to do.
Yeah.
Because we worked there. Yeah.
Did you keep, I always ask this because I'm so fascinated with them. I want to have, I don't know if it's Lori or Dave. I don't know who I'm going to have to talk about that, but did you ever keep any of the jackets?
I have almost all my jackets. I gave one to my mother, and it was my favorite one, but she
Which
just
one was said, it?
It was the one that said, it was just blue felt. It didn't have the yellow leather sleeves.
Yeah.
And it said Ed Sullivan on it.
I have that one. I love and, that one. That was the first
one. Yeah, that was a good one. And she lost it. So that one's gone. But the others,
That's tragic.
I know. The other ones I have, and they are kind of important to me. And
like, you're in Massachusetts, so like I'm in Western Canada, so like I'm excited for fall. I love jacket season, and especially I wear mine. Do you ever wear yours?
No, I never wear them. They're kind of, you know, taken care of. I've thought about pulling one out, but sometimes those big leather, you know, yellow sleeves. I don't know. I loved the all felt one, and Jerry made there was one Christmas, you know, we'd always give a gift from Jerry to the staff, and some kind of branded merch. And one year we made kind of like a pullover rain jacket thing that said, it was just black, and it just said Late Show, but in black. So it was very, you know, low key, as Jerry is. And I still wear that one sometimes, because you can't really, you know, it's not loud.
Off camera, I'll send you. I think I have one. It's not black though. It's blue, but it's certainly a windbreaker type, and it's very thin and all that. And it just says Late Show on it. Somebody from the staff gave me one. If that came from Jerry, that's very, very cool. I love the holiday gift traditions. I just literally was talking to Barbara about one. One year she gave an iPod out, a little iPod shuffle out to everybody. I think it was an 06. Wow. So it would have been
after my time.
But finding out who some of these gifts are and what they gave. Again, this is a testament to the creativity of people on the staff. I love how the department heads did that. And it was just so neat. The family that you had there off camera, you and I talked about that just for a moment. And then we'll get back to some more memories here. This was a family to you. You said off camera, and I hope I'm not telling tales out of school, this is a seminal point in your life.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a time that I made a big change in my, you know, career, and landed just by, I don't know, pure luck in this place and with these people that were so wonderful. And it was a very important part of my life. Yeah. My only regret is that I left.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, it was an amazing place. And it afforded me a lot of great experiences that I will never forget. Yeah.
I appreciate you saying that very, very much. Okay. I had a question, and then you were saying that, and I got taken with what you were saying.
It's really sweet right from the heart.
What's that?
No, tell me. You ask me first.
it got to my heart, you saying that. And I mean, again, I'm coming off of just being there and talking to so many people. And some of the people hadn't been in the theater since, the last night, and seeing them come in there for Rupert's, you know, going away, and just the mixture of emotions was, it was palpable, and everything from, you know, the glee of a high school reunion type thing to the nostalgia of seeing something you haven't seen in a long time or being in a place. It was a very surreal feeling. I love that you all have that. That's one of the reasons why that the show exists is because I think that's important. To go back to you for a second, you started in theater, you then move over and pivot, and television starts becoming part of your repertoire, and then you end up stage managing on a theater that's kind of a combination of both. Is that a thing? Were some of the theater things there when you were helping to stage manage, or was it completely different?
No, I mean, it was different, but I have to say it was just the best of both worlds. Yeah. And I had begged for a couple years to be a stage manager, but I wasn't in the DGA, the union, the Directors Guild of America. Oh. And so they said, no, not until you know, but to joining the DGA, it's like, you know, Actors Equity. It's like, you have to get a show that's DGA to be in it, but you have to, you know, it's like that catch 22 thing. You already have to have your card to be able to work on one. So I begged and begged to no avail. So then I called some guy, I can't even remember his name, and I wish I did, because I would thank him now, over at CBS News, who hired all the PAs and stuff. Yeah. And I talked him into letting me, I said, just let me observe on the morning news on the set, just so I can kind of like learn what was expected of me. And being a PA on the morning news is one of the most stressful things I've ever experienced. So I did observe, and for a couple months, and they would send cars, and I would go down at like 3:34 in the morning. My apartment was on 107th and Broadway, and they would pick me up and I'd go down there. They even paid me to observe, I think. And then I would do that show, or, you know, work on that show, and then go to the Late Show building. And I had about an hour. I don't even know if Jerry knows that I did this, but no one was in the building yet. So I would just sleep on that couch in his office for like an hour. And then by 10 o'clock I was up, and I would do the whole day at Late Show. But anyway, so that finally it was just once again, a stroke of luck. They called me one morning. I wasn't supposed to be in at the news to observe. And they said, quick, our PA is sick. If we can send a car now, we'll get you into the union. We'll get you in. And so I said, great. So I went down there and I did it. And then Biff and Corky signed my union card. And it was just like an amazing moment. And then I could stage manage. So I did that for, you know, whenever they needed, they had extra remotes, or something on 53rd Street, or someone else went out to do a remote and I was backstage, or, you know, whatever they needed.
Amy, that is so damn cool. Like so this is ambition coming out of you, like wanting this and just, okay, so I'm going to hustle, and I'm going to, you know, be that extra, go that extra mile to make this happen. And then for it actually to happen. How long of a time frame are we talking here? 6 months? Are we talking like that's,
I didn't have to do the morning news that long, thank God, because I don't think my nervous system could have taken it. I mean, it was really intense there, and that was really an intense time, but I did it and I'm grateful for it. And it taught me a lot. And then, so it was only a few months that I had to do that. And the guy, I remember, he kept saying to me, I keep getting in trouble for paying you. I don't know how you talked me in to doing this. And I would just say, well, you know, let's just keep going. Come on. And then it happened. Eventually what happened is I loved being on that, you know, being on the stage, working with everybody, being backstage. It was, and I loved the control room too. It was amazing, but I really wanted to do more stage managing. And so eventually I moved to Los Angeles thinking I was going to do a bunch more. Yeah. And the only work I really did in LA was remotes for Late Show when they, so I did that, and that was great. But it was wonderful. I loved just the way it worked out. I can't believe it.
Okay. So we got to talk about Biff and Corky here for a second. We haven't had a stage manager on here yet. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, because a different animal, very different animal, obviously, doing that compared to what you were doing before.
Yes.
Describe that a little bit. Any memorable moments from being a stage manager?
Yeah, I mean, whew, it was crazy. Well, one that my kids love to hear was when Johnny Depp was on.
Yeah.
And I was backstage with Johnny Depp, and it was way back when. So he, you know, he was famous for sure, but he was young. And
telling a story about Jack Nicholson, I believe, if that's the one I'm thinking of. Anyway,
no, this is just a little, I don't even know who knows the story except my kids. But and the Tommy who did the sound probably saw it. But we were standing backstage, and he was getting, you know, Dave was doing his intro, and Johnny Depp turned to me, and he was shaking. Like, he was so scared. He was shaking, and he said, "Can I hold your hand?" And so I said, "Of course." And so I said, "You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay." And I held his hand, and then he was called, and then he went on.
So this is in the wings, right where Dave would come out. That's where you were at that point. Okay.
Yes.
That is. Yeah. So was he longer hair, sunglasses, Johnny Depp, or was he clean cut?
I think he was longer hair. He was pretty straight. Okay. You know, it was kind of scraggly, and I just remember him shaking like a leaf. I mean, he was just terrified. It is. I mean, that was really. It was. Dave was, you know, so smart. Mm-hmm. So intelligent in the questions he asked that I feel like it was intimidating for some of the guests, and they wanted to do the right thing, say the right thing, you know.
I was talking with Joanna Jordan about this a few weeks ago, and I know that this, you guys, just so you know, and I'm going to say this, I got to proclaim this, you and your cohorts, the family, are always going to be the star of this show. This show here, as far as I'm concerned, the A-listers that I get are Amy. Like, you're an A-lister.
Oh, well, I mean, that's very kind of you, but hardly.
No, it's the truth. No, it's the truth. Like, that is what this show is. But I do want it to evolve to a place where we can get some of these people who had this reverence for Dave that they weren't allowed to talk about because segment producers beat it out of them, that says Dave does not want to know how much you care about the sketch he did, or the remote he did back in the day at late night. He doesn't care that you love him. That we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about other things. But I want this to be a venue for people, like moments like that, where they talk about how, you know, these biggest people in the world, terrified or reverent or whatever you want to call, you know, the adoration that they have for Dave. That's a really, really sweet moment and a sweet example. You got to see it. And this is one of the things that we want to put out on the show, is how many people were like that. Had they just had ultimate respect for Dave? And
yes, absolutely. Well, go for it, Mike. I hope it happens.
Absolutely. We're just having fun,
right? I'm sure it will. Another story similar to that was Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
This is back in New York though, and we were back in the wings, and he was waiting to go on, and he asked me, he was together, and he was a regular guest pretty much on the show, but he asked me to make sure his tie, you know, to straighten his tie. And I mean, of course, Mr. Hanks, you know, and I straightened his tie, but I just thought I was going to die. I mean, I was like, okay, that was a pretty cool moment. I got to straighten Tom Hanks's tie. Anyway. Yeah. But he wanted to make sure he was just so going on, you know? Yep. So there really was a reverence and a respect, I think, from most probably of the people going on there.
Certainly was. So let's talk about the stage managing. Would you be doing that job if Biff was away on a remote or something like that? Is that when they would tap you to say, "Okay, come on up, Bill. Biff's at the Super Bowl right now. You got to come up here and do this."
Yes, that was what would happen. And sometimes they'd call in, you know, a couple others over from CBS. And then there was a guy, Frankie, who would stage manage as an extra, as a third. And sometimes we'd have four on that night. You know, it just depended what was going on. And if you had things going on, like the Hooters moment I mentioned to you, the remote inside Hooters, I had a camera guy with me. I was stage managing that night, and my headset went out, which was disaster, because I had to know like where everybody had to be. Jerry was telling me in the headset. And so thank God the camera guy there, his headset was still live and he had to do the whole thing. And I was terrified. I mean, I couldn't believe that I didn't know what to do anyway. So then there would be someone else, you know, two others. There was always one on the stage at all times, you know, and then one back in the wings, and then whoever needed to be with different remotes that went live during the show.
You just segued beautifully into a question that I had. When you started stage managing, I assume the experience that you had in the control room and understanding the flow of the direction part of the show served you very, very well. And helping to flow it from that perspective as well. That was probably a lot of cool things that, you know, the fact that it would be Jerry in your ear, like that's a good thing right there. Right.
Yes. I felt very comfortable with Jerry, there. So, you know, telling me what to do. And I mean, I was new at it and it was like the biggest show on television. So I'm sure I screwed up, you know, a few times for sure. But I did really, I think it helped knowing who everybody was. And I had been used to handing out those shot sheets to the camera guys. So I was kind of familiar with them. And so it, do that. Those days they said, okay, you can stage manage, I, you know, cheered. Plus I got paid a little more. So that was nice too.
Yeah, absolutely. That union, that sweet union money. People have always asked, like we've had Biff's son came on the show here. We haven't had Biff on, and there's a chance that he might come on with his dad, which would be kind of neat if we did it that way. But there's been a lot of people who have asked me to say, okay, well, what exactly does a stage manager do? You know, it seems like Biff's available whenever Dave calls for him. It seems he's right there. It seems that he's there, you know, when Dave runs out. But what would you say that job description of the stage manager would be for the people who don't know?
Mostly it depends where you are. Mm-hmm. In the building, you know, what your job is that day, but as a stage manager, but Biff being on stage would be in charge of counting people into commercial and out of commercial. So a lot of times, you know, he's giving the, you know, sign to it's time for commercial. It's time for commercial. If Dave and the guest are having a great, you know, conversation.
So you're an eye shot with Dave and you're saying, you know, 2 minutes, 1 minute kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So counting down and then counting. Then coming back, you know, the commercials were all that time slot, you know, because you've been there many times, but how they count them back in from the so-called commercial break. And so that's the stage manager that's there on stage is mainly responsible for that. And then the one backstage is mostly, you know, making sure you've got your next guest who's coming on and making sure, you know, everybody has what they need. And usually like a producer would, you know, come back there and make sure they walk their guest back there or make sure it's like I said, it's a team effort. So, and then, and you're communicating. So Biff was communicating with the control room with Jerry when he was on stage and same with backstage, as we mentioned. And then if you're on a remote, if all goes well, you're also communicating. It's basically, you're the conduit between the control room and what's happening and, you know, live in front of you.
What would you do during rehearsal? Would you need to know the beats of the show and the stage manager paying attention a lot? Did they make decisions as to how things would go rehearsal?
They made decisions, definitely. And we would go to also to the production meetings in the morning. So that was, you know, we knew kind of roughly what was going on that day.
Go ahead.
You tell me.
So when you were meetings at the beginning of the day is another really good you know example. So when you were working for Jerry, would you ever go to the writers meetings, things like that, or was it like when the writers had an extra to pitch, things like that, did they come down and find you guys?
Oftentimes they would come down and say, you know, got to meet with Jerry, and Jerry wasn't there, we'd find him, or Jerry would say, you know, his phone would ring and send Jerry up. We're talking about something else. And Jerry would go running up the stairs. I mean, there was that, you didn't have to take, you know, there are those stairs between the different floors. So where you didn't have to take the elevator every time. So I don't know how many times a day he went running up and down those stairs, but quite a lot. And I was mostly just kind of gatekeeper. If someone needed him, you know, help them find him or tell Jerry someone stopped by. It was that kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
This one's going to sound like it's out of the blue, but it's sort of an inside story that's happened, a narrative that's happening within the Letterman podcast and people outside of it. Were you there when the microphone got stolen?
No.
You weren't there when that happened? Okay. Did you hear about that?
No, Dave's... tell me.
Well, there was a time where the microphone that Dave had stolen from NBC and brought over with him, and I mean, there's a lot of history behind that. That microphone was stolen, and it was right around the time that the set design changed to the new bridge set. I always wanted to hear the perspective of people who were around the control room, because it was kept down there.
I should know. I wonder. I probably was there then, because I was there when the set changed, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, the person who stole the microphone has, you know, he's a friend of the show and whatnot, and he's talked with Barbara and Walt. Like it's out there now, but it's a pretty fun story. But I always ask the question to somebody who might have been there during the time if what their perspective was.
That's a big story there.
Another one of the hard-hitting stories that we try and uncover here at the Letterman podcast.
Well, that's a good behind-the-scenes one, because I was there and I don't remember it. So that's pretty good.
It's I've got stuff I'll send you outside of this if ever you want to go down a rabbit hole and kill some time.
Absolutely. Love to do that.
I just appreciate your time here. Now, I love to have a little bit of potpourri. I'm going to finish by asking... you know, what you're doing now and what life looks like now. You know, this is a seminal part of your life, and I want to make sure if there's anything that you did want to talk about, any stories that have come to you that you want to throw out here. And by the way, standing invite, anytime you want to come back here, if you think of a story that you just want to tell, we'll fire it up even for 5 or 10 minutes and throw it out there to do it. Like I want this to be a place where all of the family can come here at any time and tell a story. So know that you have a standing invite for that, Amy.
Thank you. I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
So is there anything else at the time at Letterman? Because I want to talk about your decision to leave and you moving on and going to LA a little bit. I want to get there. Is there anything about the time of the show that you want to reiterate here before we move to that phase?
I don't think so. I think I've said it, though, you know, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll say, oh my God, I missed that story.
Yep.
But for right now, exactly. I'll keep that notepad next to my bed. but otherwise, I mean, it was just, I think I've said most of what, I mean, of course, there's just so many stories, but most of what I wanted to say. Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. You were there for about 6 years.
And so
painful decision to leave. Was it ambition? Like, I mean, you clearly have this ambition.
It was ambition.
Yeah.
And I decided to go, and I knew that Worldwide Pants was producing a show with Craig, late show with Craig Kilborn.
Absolutely.
They were about to do that. And so at my exit interview with Dave, I said, which I don't know how I got. I don't know if everybody does those or not, but
What? Hold on. You had an actual exit interview with David Letterman?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he chatted with me for a long time. I mean, a long time. He had popcorn. He just had a big bowl of popcorn and said, okay. And so we hung out in his office. Lori Diamond was outside. She kept kind of checking in saying, do you need anything? You know, and I just kind of talked about my time there. And then I asked him, I said, I don't want to be too forward, but could I stage manage the new Late Late Show? And I'm going out to LA. I kind of like took a chance. And he said, sure. And he called up, I guess it was Rob Burnett at the time.
Yeah.
And he said, Amy's, you know, going out to LA, and why don't we put her on the show? And I mean, I was there in the room. And we shook hands and I said, thank you very much. And I moved to LA. I gave up my apartment. I drove out there. And when I got to LA, I moved in with an old friend from college, and there was a massive, massive bouquet of flowers. I mean, it covered like our whole dining room table that said, they were stunning. And it said, good luck in LA, love Dave. And and then I got to meet Brian McAloon, was the director. Yep. Yep. And I met with him and he took my meeting. I went to his office and he said, so what can I do for you? And I said, well, I moved out here and I thought I was stage managing this show. Anyway, total miscommunication. Craig Kilborn had hired his guy, which was great. You know, that was fine. Yep. Brian couldn't have been nicer. And I was naive. I just kind of like went out there on a wing and a prayer, hoping I had the job. I didn't sign a contract or anything. I just hoped.
Wow.
And because in the past, stuff worked out for me.
Talk about a life event, life lesson, whatever you want to call it. Oh my gosh.
I took the leap and it didn't, you know, but the very long story, probably longer than you wanted to know, story with this is once again, this is before internet and all that stuff. So the only contact, I had no money. I had spent everything on buying a car and moving to LA. So the only contact I had was on the back of the card from the flower shop, was the number of the flower shop, and they were really pretty flowers. So I called them and I said, do you need, you know, I need a job. And they hired me at the flower shop. And it turned out to be, they're still there, Mark's Garden. On Ventura
Shout out
Boulevard.
To Mark's Garden. Thanks for helping a girl out while she was in a time of need.
And they,
oh my
they
God,
did.
Amy.
And it ended up being like the premier, like they supplied flowers for all the studios. And I would take it. And so I would answer the phones and take messages. And so suddenly I knew like everything that was going on, like people that were getting hired and, you know,
you got connected inadvertently.
In this bizarro way. Yeah. And so it was actually, I had a great time working there. And then in the meantime, you know, Late Show would call me if they did a remote, like on the roof of CBS out in LA, I would stage manage that. And then I was in LA and I worked at some other shows. I worked a little bit like I was on Drew Carey's show and got myself on the set of Friends and the X-Files and did a few others, but nothing.
How
was
cool
like,
was Friends? Did you sit on the couch?
I did not get to go to the couch. I only got as far as like maybe the craft services table, but
that's where I would have stopped too.
which was like all zone. So it wasn't fun anyway. It was all like diet food. And And then I decided about 8 months later, 8 months to a year, I was like, you know, I'm a New Yorker through and through. And I said, I'm going to move back. So I drove my car and literally I was in Iowa and my cell phone rang. And it was Brian McAloon. And he said, okay, we're ready to train you to start working on the show. And I said, well, I'm headed back to New York. The phone call's a little too late, but thank you so much. So they did follow through on the offer to hire me, but it just happened a little later than I thought it would. And and then when I got back to New York, I did, they would page me or call me, and I freelanced as a stage manager from time to time. And then I started working a lot in Jerry Foley's sister, Joanne, was working at a corporate production house. Yeah. They did, you know, all kinds of corporate meetings. And when I got back to New York and needed a job, she hired me over there. And so I started doing those and I met my husband and I was traveling all the time with that company. So ended up not doing as much, you know, of the show. And then I had kids and that was that. But
and then family becomes the center focal point.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was great too. And I mean, but I even brought, I think a couple times I brought my kids by the stage door And, you know, during music rehearsal, and they'd say, come in, you know, and brought us in to get to watch. So, I mean, they were still, and I went to that first reunion after the show ended, and that was really amazing. And so over time, I've seen people a few times. Of course, then, you know, I have some dear friends who I still see whenever humanly possible, though we're spread out around the country.
Talking about the reunion, you know, and I'm not telling tales out of school here in saying this. I've actually said it in another episode that actually hasn't aired. So it's, a little bit of time travel. I'm going to say this, and it's already aired in another episode. when Rupert was going to go off, like, we have one sponsor here at the Letterman Podcast. It's Rupert G and the Hello Deli. I love Rupert and May to death. When Rupert had decided to sell the deli, I'd said to him, I said, okay, so what's going to happen? Is there going to be a thing? And he's like, no, I think I'm just going to ride off into the sunset. And when the Pants people found out about this, Walter himself found out about this, he went to Rupert and said, no, we need to do something. We need to have a reunion of some sort. And Rupert was like, well, I don't know. And he goes, no, you don't understand. The trend has been, we're only getting together when someone dies. We need to get together when something wonderful happens. At that point, Rupert agreed to it, which is a sweet story in of itself to everybody. It shows Rupert's humbleness, but then it shows the desire. One thing I got to say to you is I hope our paths are going to cross at one of these future reunions. You know, I hope that this event ignited people's idea of doing more of these to celebrate things, because it is a family. Yes. You know, and you go off and you have your own family and your life shifts. But that point in your life, you know, even that you talk about friends, you know, when Marta Kaufman talks about what friends was, it was the idea of this group of people that were each other's family before they went out and got married and had families. And that was what the premise of the show was.
Yes.
You know, I think about Carter and Craig with How I Met Your Mother. The bar in that show was based on McGee's. It was based on what you guys did together as a family. And I could not be more excited and honored to watch and to be a part of this in that way. I hope our paths cross at a future event, but
I hope so too. Yeah.
I want to talk about your son. Your son just is got a book that he's just written and is coming out. I couldn't be more excited. Can you talk about what your son's doing?
He is 17 years old. He's a senior in high school, and he's a techie, like tech guy, and wants to go to university for computer engineering. And he has spent most of his childhood just patiently, painstakingly trying to teach my mother and her friends and my mother-in-law how to use their iPhone. And you just show them again and again, and they can't remember how to turn it off and on and how to do, you know, different things with it.
Basic
functions, just the basic things. So he wrote a book called Nanotech, and it's about it's the top 10. Ironic that we're talking about that today. Essential functions of your iPhone. So it's just all laid out in like really simple language with pictures and arrows and things like that. And so we'll see what happens. It goes up on Amazon in another, hopefully a week, maybe two. They take a while. And so he's excited about it.
And he's 17.
For iPhone. He's 17.
How precious is that? Like, and not just precious, commendable and whatnot. You talk about this ambition of you going to work for the CBS Morning News 3 a.m. and then doing a full shift at Late Show. You know, did he get his ambition from you? Is that,
I don't know, probably much to his dismay, but, I don't know. He's his own person for sure. And I know nothing about tech. I do know how to use my phone most of the time, but he's a cool kid. I'm proud of him that he did this, and hopefully he'll get into college. that's his focus at the moment, is getting into college. So
author on the application form will definitely raise some eyebrows. I think that is
amazing. Hope so.
Is he do we have a website for it yet? Is that does
not
it have a landing
yet
page for it?
No,
okay.
But there will
Nanotech.
Be, yeah, Nanotech.
Well, wouldn't it be cool if, I mean, that is such a cute amazing human interest. Or hey, for any of the human interest producers that watch the show, and there are actually a couple former ones anyway, and there are a few. What an amazing human interest story. You know, maybe we need to message Brian Tedda or something like that. It's the coolest thing in the world.
That'd be awesome. Anything. If they've listened to this podcast that long, nothing, you know, if they found my stories that interesting. I mean, I really appreciate you having me on because as I mentioned to you, when you first reached out to me, I just feel like, I mean, I was just the tiniest part of this massive, amazing accomplishment, and people were there for decades, and it's just amazing. So I hope it was interesting to somebody.
Are you kidding me? Okay, so we are getting to the end here. I gotta ask this. Did the nervousness go away?
Oh yeah, you're great to talk to, so it was fun. And also, it's rare, I think my family is so sick of hearing these stories, that it's rare that I get to like tell the stories to an enthusiastic audience. So thanks for that.
Standing invite anytime you want. And anyone that you remember, anyone that you want to relive, standing invite. You can come here anytime to talk about this. You know, it's funny. We've had some of the interns on over the summer. We had 5 or 6 intern shows, and mm-hmm. and they have the same thing to say that you had to say, being there, you know, about six years, the same thing that some of the folks who were there for 32 years had to say. You talk about the seminal point in your life. You put it perfectly. So many people, whether it was just a brush or mm-hmm. it was an entire career, look mm-hmm. at their time at that place, whether it was in 30 Rock or at the Ed Sullivan Theater, as a seminal point in their life. You did a great job talking about this. You are absolutely, you and anybody else who worked for that production are absolutely, there is no unworthiness when it comes to this show and people who were connected. The Letterman Podcast is a celebration of this stuff. Amy, you are amazing. I just want to say thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be on here.
Thank you for having me. It was absolutely my pleasure. Such fun.
Oh, good. I'm going to shoot a really quick outro, and then I'll come right back and we'll say our goodbye privately, if that's okay with
you. Super. Yep. Thanks.
Oh, amazing. Okay. So yeah, this is why we do the show. I just absolutely adored this episode. I think you all probably did as well. Amy is charming and joyful and just so grateful. I love that so much. And if and when we get Jerry Foley on this thing, I feel a little bit more like we're prepped for it as well. So cool to put the pieces of this amazing puzzle together, celebrating the greatest body of broadcasting work in history. The Letterman Podcast, brought to you by the Hello Deli. Go to hello-deli.com. If you still the only place that you can get official Late Show with David Letterman merchandise, mugs and hats and caps and whatnot, packed by Rupert himself, not from the deli anymore, but from another location. Go to hello-deli.com and get your pieces of Letterman merchandise while you still can. This has been another episode of the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. Coincidentally, I am Mike Chisholm. Thank you and good night.
Overcoat and underpants.